Audi, and welcome to Bombsta, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Atwasagay. In today's program, we'll hear from two chiefs who sit on the BC All Chiefs Task Force. The task force has launched a mass letter-writing and email campaign to press the Harper government to sign on to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, as well as initiate a national public inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada. And we now know that the Harper government has promised his commitments to these two very important issues in Wednesday's throne speech. And there are two more initiatives in the country to help youth stay out of gangs or help them exit that kind of lifestyle. Bombsta co-op student Deidre Conten spoke with the National Aboriginal Gang Prevention Commissioner Cliff Summers and the commissioner's spokesperson Adam Beach, as well as the CEO and creator of the Seven Generations Healing Network, Mike Gladue. And stay tuned to hear about how the Chitimacha tribe in Louisiana is breathing new life into its language with the help of modern technology. Plus, Tracy Recollet is one of the women who danced in the opening ceremonies of the 2010 Winter Games, and she told Bombsta how it felt to be there. The stories plus great tunes coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. The BC All Chiefs Task Force is hoping the warm feelings from the Winter Olympics will last. For the first time in history, Aboriginal people were involved with the event and planned alongside the Olympic Committee. First Nations were able to highlight their issues in international media. The issues went from poverty to rights and title, along with Canada's refusal to sign the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People and neglect to initiate a public inquiry in missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada. The BC All Chiefs Task Force has launched a postcard and email campaign to urge Canada to sign the declaration and begin a public inquiry. BC Chief Bev Percival Clifton sits on the task force and says the public inquiry is very important.
It's really critical for us. We come from societies that are matrilineal, where women play an important role. We have lost now generations of women in our communities, and there has been absolutely no attention paid.
Meanwhile, Percival Clifton's colleague on the task force, Chief Wayne Christensen, says they're calling on all Canadians to help.
We're asking the public through the postcard campaign to get directly involved, either through the postcard campaign and a letter to their prime minister, and or emails directly to his office.
Christensen adds media played an important role during the Olympics, and he says it should continue. Meanwhile, Assembly of First Nations National Chief Sean Atleo is encouraged by Wednesday's throne speech. Canada made a commitment to endorse the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. Atleo stated in a press release that the UN document and its principles of reconciliation and partnership can guide all the other important work referenced in the speech from the throne. The speech also included a commitment to address the disturbing number of unsolved cases in the country's national epidemic of missing and murdered Aboriginal women. The National Chief said it's a huge step forward and comes on the heels of two decades of advocacy and numerous calls to action. The transfer of the Iprawash Provincial Park to the Chippewas of Kettle and Stony Point First Nation is another step closer to reality. Ontario is going to deregulate the parkland so it can be transferred to the federal government, then transferred back to Kettle and Stony Point First Nation. Returning the land to the community was a key recommendation of the Iprawash Inquiry. The inquiry investigated the death of Dudley George, who in 1995 had been shot and killed by an OPP officer in the park. George had been occupying the park with other community members, protecting burial grounds. There are two new intervention prevention strategies in Canada to help combat the growing concern of Aboriginal youth involvement in gangs. The National Aboriginal Gang Prevention Commission is looking for feedback from across Canada to develop its prevention strategies. Cliff Summers is the chair of the commission. He hopes collecting the stories and developing the strategy will help youth stay out of gangs.
Just by people becoming aware of what it is that they're having to deal with, and it's, you know, pretty nasty stuff that they have to experience and have to deal with, that will hopefully be enough to maybe prevent somebody from getting caught up in gangs.
The other new initiative, an intervention strategy, is the Seven Generations Healing Network, which will include a safe house for ex-gang members. Toronto resident Mike Gladue is the creator and CEO of the network. Gladue says the two-year program will include four phases and introduce the youth to culture, healing, and education.
We'll have them out in the wilderness, learning about themselves,
our traditions, the wild, our respect with nature, and start a GED program, as well as work on all the anger and aggression issues. And then we move them into an urban setting where they will reside for 8 months in a transitional house environment. We're going to create a education package.
Cladue says the program is funded through private corporate sponsors and partnerships, along with government money for startup costs. Cladue adds he will be starting a cross-country walk in May to raise awareness about his organization, plus raise more money for the programs.
Ashti'i?
That's hello in Chittimacha. The audio is an example from the Rosetta Stone software. The corporation is helping the Chittimacha tribe of Louisiana revive its language through its Endangered Languages program. It took about 3 years to create Chittimacha language software. Kimberly Walden is the cultural director for the Chittimacha tribe. Walden says the program has been in the tribal school for about a month now, and there are already results.
We are already seeing great things with bringing back the language, just the pride in the children.
The community had begun a language revitalization program in 1997, but it was hard because the cultural department was working from linguist field notes as well as Chittimacha language recordings on wax cylinders from more than 65 years ago. It was even more difficult to revive the language because the last Chittimacha speaker died in 1940. Marion Bittinger is the manager of the Rosetta Stone Endangered Languages program. She says it wasn't easy to develop the software.
It was very challenging. It was inspirational. It was fascinating. It involved a lot of challenges that we had never had to encounter before.
Bittinger says it took people both in the community and company to create the software, and she says team members also had to create new phrases and new words to fill in the gaps. The Chittimacha Rosetta Stone software is owned and distributed by the tribe. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Yes, are dry and dead, and sun beats down above our heads. Yes, sun beats down above our heads, but I, oh, I will bring you water. Yes, I, oh, I will bring you water. I will quench your
Bring the Water by Digging Roots from their CD, We Are. That CD is one of five that has received a Juno nomination in the Aboriginal Album of the Year category. Other nominees in the category include Distant Morning Star by Digga Wolf, Inez's album, Sing Soul Girl, Swagger from Lucy Itilau, and Trail of Tears by Winla Valley. The BC All Chiefs Task Force has launched an email and letter writing campaign to urge the Harper government to sign on to the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People, plus initiate a national public inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada. Chief Bev Clifton-Percival sits on that committee.
Well, one of the reasons we chose the Olympics as a starting point to raise awareness is because there are so many challenges facing First Nations people. In British Columbia, we've been dealing over the last decade with murdered and missing women in our province, both on Highway 16 and down in the Lower Mainland in the downtown east side, one of the poorest neighborhoods in Canada. As along with that, we were dealing with the poverty issues, and we were dealing with the fact that Canada refused to sign the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. As well, in this province, we have the unsettled land question, and the Crown has refused to deal with it in a just manner. And so you have a lot of frustration on First Nations part in wanting to deal with substantive issues, and the Crown refusing or denying that these issues need to be dealt with.
And how important is it to have these issues dealt with in a timely manner?
I think it's critical. We're at a critical moment in history for us. We've been patient. We've waited. We have a lot of court decisions in this province that are directing the Crown to act in good faith and to negotiate issues and to see resolution to these outstanding issues. And the Crown has failed to act on that, and we have tried many different venues. So the Olympics is just a starting point in this public education and media campaign. We are going to step it up until we have the attention of the Crown and that they come to the table in good faith and deal with it.
Okay, and can you explain the demand to have a public inquiry or a national public inquiry into missing and murdered women in Canada?
It's really critical for us. We come from societies that are matrilineal, where women play an important role, and we have lost now generations of women in our communities, and there has been absolutely no attention paid. We see inquiries happen in other instances with other groups of people, but it seems to me that one of the most marginalized populations that has lost an increasingly large number of women has not been looked at, has not been investigated, and has not seen any kind of remedy sought to stop this kind of violence against our women in our communities.
Okay, and I also understand that you have an email campaign to email the Prime Minister regarding the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
Yes, we do. We have an email postcard campaign, and we are looking at doing more after the Olympics. We respect what the Olympics means and the countries, but we realize also that we have an opportunity to share our story and to apply political pressure to the Prime Minister, to the Premier of this province.
And what kind of media attention has this been gathering? And then my second part of the question is, what kind of role should media play in this?
Well, I think media can play a big role in terms of educating the public. There's very little knowledge of our issues, even though we are Indigenous people to this continent and to this country. The mainstream public knowledge of what it is we have as challenges, what it is we have happening in our communities, what the Crown is doing, is not well known. So our opportunity here was to reach out to the international media, and we have had several series of interviews with the media that has been in the city over the last 10 days, and it has allowed us to put that out there. And we have had our information in print around the different at the Aboriginal Pavilion. We have worked with the four hosts, and we will maintain our respect with them, as is our culture. But we have received a lot of good media on these issues and that press release each week to deal with issues. And we are going to take it, as I say, to the next step and move it forward again. And we'll focus on Canada, and we'll still focus on the international one as well, and here in the province.
Because of the Olympics, there's been an international spotlight. Are you a little concerned that perhaps the media attention will fall by the wayside after the Olympics are done?
No, I don't think that's going to be the case. Many of us have worked in many different levels and many different forums, so that's something that we will reach out and continue to network with other Indigenous peoples around the world in the United States. here in Canada. So we don't have a fear that that's there. I think also they might look back and pick up more once they see what coverage has been there.
Okay, and is there anything else you'd like to say or add?
Well, I think it's really critical for the Crown to step up and to deal with these issues. For us, we have waited a long time for the issues to be acted on, and the law is now on our side, and it continues to be on our side as we go to court. And if the Crown doesn't want to continue to go to court, then they have to do what the courts are directing them to do, which is to negotiate in good faith and to keep the honor of the Crown.
That was BC Chief Bev Clifton-Percival. Her colleague, also on the committee, Chief Wayne Christensen, estimates the number of missing and murdered Aboriginal women to be 6 times higher than the number originally estimated, which is about 500 in the last 15 years. Meanwhile, in Wednesday's speech from the throne, the government made a commitment to endorse the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, plus address the disturbing number of unsolved cases in the country's national epidemic of missing and murdered Aboriginal women. There are two new initiatives in Canada meant to address the growing concern of Aboriginal youth and gangs. BOMCDA co-op student Deidre Conton has the story.
First Nation youth involvement in gangs is a growing concern. It has been reported that 22% of youth and gangs in Canada are First Nations. A 2006 Canadian Research Institute study also reported that there are a total of 77 specific Canadian anti-gang programs. The programs cover prevention to intervention strategies. There are now two more positive programs to add to that slim roster. 42-year-old Mike Gladu took it upon himself to start the Seven Generations Healing Network, a non-profit organization which will include a safe house to reintegrate ex-gang members into their communities. Gladu made this choice after his 18-year-old son survived 3 gunshots to the chest in Toronto. Meanwhile, the Congress of Aboriginal People created a National Aboriginal Prevention Gang Commission, which is now an independent commission. Cliff Summers is the chair of that commission, and actor Adam Beach is the commission's national spokesperson. Gladu says the concept to start the Seven Generations organization was not something new to him because he didn't start out with a positive step in life.
The Awasis Naganote Safe House strategy, which I've created, I've been developing basically for the better part of 25 years since I was a youngin. I was 16 years old when I was already into my life of crime and addiction. And an older gentleman asked me what I needed to try and live a better lifestyle and clean thought patterns. And this is what's become of it.
And Gladu says he began to develop the Safe House Initiative a couple of years ago.
Basically, I came up with this idea that put everything 2 years ago when my 18-year-old son at the time took 3 bullet slugs in the chest here in Toronto.
Cliff Summers, chair of the National Aboriginal Gang Prevention Commission, says the organization realized the need for that strategy.
The role that we see that we can play on the commission is probably twofold. Basically, number one, whenever the commission sits, and the plan is that we're going to go across the country and we're going to go into cities where there are especially serious and bad problems as far as gangs are concerned. Last year, because the National Aboriginal Gang Conference was in Edmonton, we began the whole process by having hearings in Edmonton. And so the problem of gangs in Edmonton is a pretty serious problem. But it's probably as serious or maybe even more serious in places like Winnipeg. Probably the one place in the country where the whole gang movement might have had its earliest beginnings would be in Winnipeg. But in Regina, the problem is bad. Maybe, I know, between Regina and between Winnipeg, those two cities seem to kind of, not like they're competing against each other, but one city tends to be compared to the other because of the high level of violence. And there's a lot of murders that, you know, of innocent victims, innocent, mostly Aboriginal people, and most often than not, they're innocent victims who kind of get, you know, they're at the wrong place at the wrong time. So last year when we sat as the commission, we spoke to members of family, mothers whose daughters and whose one case, there was a gentleman who was murdered. There were, I think, two young girls whose parents, whose mothers came to the commission and talked to the commission. And we even had some gang members who came and talked to the commission. And so the whole idea of trying to bring about some effort to prevent people from joining gangs is to really kind of bring the issue kind of out of the inner cities and bringing it to a forum, bringing it to a place with the commission where, you know, we're going to sit and we're going to hear suggestions and the ideas that parents may have or that ex-gang members may have. We have a couple of our commissioners. One commissioner in particular is not only she an ex-gang member, but she's a former spouse of someone who was one of the leaders of a gang. And so, you know, those are pretty important perspectives that we can have for our work as a commission to get ideas about, first of all, what women who are spouses of leaders of gangs have to cope with. And just by people becoming aware of what it is that they're having to deal with, and, you know, pretty nasty stuff that they have to experience and have to deal with, that will hopefully be enough to maybe prevent somebody from getting caught up in gangs.
Meantime, Gladys' organization, Seven Generations, will focus on intervention with its two-year program. The program sounds pretty ambitious. Gladu says the program will require participants to work through four stages, from traditional healing to academics to training programs.
It'll be a two-year program. It'll be divided up into four different stages. The first stage will have them out in the wilderness, learning about themselves, our traditions, the wild, our respect with nature, and start a GED program, as well as work on all their anger and aggression issues. And then we're going to move them into an urban setting where they will reside for 8 months in a transitional house environment. We're going to create a education package with Mr. Philip Deering and the district school boards from each municipality that we hope to approach. And there they will learn more fundamentals of empowering themselves, addressing their culture and their respect, learning the core respect values we have for our women and our women's power and our women's teachings. And programs are being set up for this project. One in the entertainment and fashion industry, all aspects of it will be a training program to be in front of the camera. You name it, actor, actress, behind the camera, sound technician, the fashion industry, all of that be created by Mr. Dakota House and Ms. Jennifer Podemski and a few other of their team members. And a construction trade certification program is being developed, myself included in this one, with Waskegan Corporation from Quebec, Mr. Gilles Berube, Mr. Dale Provenost, the head of the Iron Workers Union for basically the globe, both Mohawk gentlemen that are interested in assisting me with this project, and we're going to train them and certify them in all aspects of home building with environmental cost-efficient technology. And with that, we're going to develop another proposal to go to the AFN and have these former at-risk youth from all across the country, ones to go back to their Aboriginal communities, Métis communities, and build better, environmentally safe, cost-efficient homes. And we're just about done finalizing that proposal. DeSales Trust, a Native-owned bank, be able to offer a home and mortgage to each and every individual on Aboriginal community land. A lot of them get welfare, government assistance for shelter and housing. We're trying to channel that towards a home and mortgage. We're partners from Habitat for Humanity, Peace Hills Trust. We're hoping that could see the light of day. We do have serious commitment and people working on both sides of those two entities trying to make this reality. And then after they spend their 8 months in the transition house, we will have them living in independent living situations, taking evening programming, recreation programming, you name it, whatever their interests are. We're going to plan that into activities, continue up, follow-up group sessions. And then after they are done the program for 2 years, from the wilderness aspect to the end of independent living, Habitat for Humanity is going to give each participant a home and mortgage.
Gladys says funding for the program comes from a variety of private corporate grants and partnerships, along with government funding for the startup phase. Actor Adam Beach is the national spokesperson for the National Aboriginal Gang Prevention Commission. Beach says he chose to be part of the commission's anti-gang strategy because something needs to be done, and he thinks gangs are one of the residual effects caused by residential school, and he calls gang violence a virus.
I was involved in, you know, just being a role model and being outspoken that, you know, gangs are infesting our communities and our urban centers and that we have to do something about it. Because if we don't do something about it, you know, it's like what's happening now is the gangs and drugs are acting like a virus in our communities. And because of the history of residential schools and the history of survival for our people maintaining our culture and identity, it's the perfect virus that could destroy our culture and our people within the next 20 years because of how we've shut the doors in our communities at letting anybody in and letting anybody out. And nobody talks about their problems and issues. And this is an issue we have to talk about because it's infecting a lot of communities. And if you're a community that is hard to reach or you're on an island, it's like pretty sad, you know, that nobody's out there helping out.
The Aboriginal Gang Prevention Commission is starting up once again after its breakoff from the Congress of Aboriginal Peoples. Cliff Summers.
We're starting to relaunch our Gang Prevention Commission. We want it to be clear that, you know, even though a lot of us who are involved on the commission are people who are kind of experts in the area, we still, you know, don't want anybody to think that, you know, we have all of the answers. The one thing, you know, we want to try to do something because something has to be done. And so that's the most important thing. But equally as important is we want people to get in touch with us so that, you know, if they have ideas, suggestions about things that we need to look at or things that we ought to do, then we would welcome the feedback.
Summers adds the commission is in the midst of creating a website to be able to accept more feedback and ideas on prevention strategies. Like Mike Gladue, Adam Beach's personal history is also intertwined with a life of crime, and that's why his work on the Gang Prevention Commission is important to him.
I was involved in gangs and part of the whole gang system in the 80s, and I found a way out to basically, you know, get out of the gang system and become who I am. Three, part of that was, you know, putting myself and learning about myself as an Indian of respect through culture and traditions and learning that there's something there available for us that's our right and in our heart as being Aboriginal descent. So add all these three together, that's kind of the direction the Gang Commission is headed toward. And what I have to share is my experience. And I want to change the demographic, and I want to change the perspective and the image that people look at us to be when they see an Indian on the street or a young Indian woman.
Mike Gladue, meanwhile, will soon be kicking off a national cross-country walk to raise awareness and more money for the Seven Generations organization. The walk will kick off May 3rd in Vancouver and end in Hamilton by late November, in time for the Canadian Aboriginal Festival. For Bombsida, I'm Deidre Conton.
Here it comes again, the storm, the wind, so grab hold tight. Watch close as I hold the kite. The light from the fire is enough to burn the skin. The one separates when we're trapped within. The more I know, it seems the less I take. The more I give, it seems the less I relate. It's so easy to see how hard this can get. This job is bigger than anyone wants to admit. And I've heard all these voices keep ringing in my head. The young, the old, the unborn and the dead. And they all say we're hanging by this tiny little thread. I won't be the one to cut quick to the end. I'd rather take it on with a battle cry. Try when you say you only live once, all the more reason why. Motivation keeps slipping, this path I keep tripping. Clouds keep gripping the clear blue skies. Confused by the issues, the time passes by. The answer is the people making it, breaking it to survive. You see earth and everything on it that suffers and dies. Come on people, slow down so we can keep her alive. The people, it's all about the people. It's all about the people, the people, the people. It's all about the people. But is it all about the people? I said the people, it's all about the people. It's all about the people, the people, the people. It's all about the people. But is it all about the people?
about the people.
Where do we start? Many here in the heart, with the ghettos and the people that have fallen apart. Been socially marked, engaged by the struggles of life. All parts of the same puzzle, but no pieces alike. Seeing the light by teaching how to read and to write. Gone sentence, how we're speaking on our freedom of rights. Leading the fight, cause achieving is believing in sight. Bringing power to the people by making masses unite. It's for the good of mankind and misfortune and health. Of what can only be described by pains that others have felt. And this promise isn't preaching, it's just asking for help. And I know nothing is possible, but it's hard by myself. Cause how can they build if they don't have the supplies? Large populations are starving, taking innocent lives. We need to revise, recognize in order to rise. Cause the numbers of the suffering are only growing in size.
The people, it's all about the people. It's all about the people, it's all about the people. But is it all about the people? I said the people, it's all about the people. It's all about the people, it's all about the people. But is it all about the people? The people, it's all about the people. It's all about the people, it's all about the people. But is it all about the people? I said the people, it's all about the people. It's all about the people, it's all about the people. But is it all about the people?
How we exhibit our sound. How we exhibit our sound to the people.
The People from Equal and Mills from their CD, The List. The Chitimacha tribe of Louisiana is bringing back its language with the help of modern technology. That revival is being made possible with the trademarked Rosetta Stone software. The corporation is helping the tribe revive its language through its Endangered Languages program. Kimberly Walden is the cultural director for the Chitimacha tribe.
We started working with Rosetta Stone through a grant we received through their Endangered Language program. We wanted to use Rosetta Stone to supplement what we had already been doing since 1997 with trying to bring back our language, which was unspoken since 1940. And we really looked to Rosetta Stone to have that technological component that is interesting for young people. And also because the program is immersion-based, so with only a handful or less speakers and instructors, we wanted to reach more tribal members. And this technology in the hands of every tribal member is really going to help increase the folks that have language knowledge of Chitimacha.
When did you start implementing the program?
We just finished the program. We went to Rosetta Stone. We wanted to be there when our products came off the assembly line, which they told us was a different request. Usually they do a what they call a tag-off, sign-off, where it's a celebration when you sign off that the product is done in, as far as it is, and going into production. And so we asked to be there. So that happened the end of January. And then we came home, and the Monday, I guess we came home on the Thursday, the Monday we started 94 students on Rosetta Stone. We set up their usernames and passwords at a training while we were at Rosetta Stone. We ended up with the receiving, in addition to the 1,000 copies of the product and the online access, we ended up with the teacher resource materials, the student management system. So we had a training on that. We entered all of our students' names and passwords and got everything set up ready to go. So we started the students on that, and then we just sent flyers to every tribal household informing them that the product was now available, either the online version or the product, the CD, high-speed internet. So we began distributing those as well. So it's going out to the broader community, not just the tribal school students. And our students are using it. I think this is going to be the third week. And we have the students on the computers twice a week, so Mondays and Wednesdays are their Rosetta Stone days.
Okay, and how long are they on there for?
Our classroom is a supplement to the regular program. So we get kindergarten through eighth grade students about 30 minutes a day for 4 days a week.
It took 3 years to create the Rosetta Stone software in the Chittimacha language and a team of people from both the community and corporation. Marion Bittinger is the manager of the Rosetta Stone Endangered Languages Program, and she says Chittimacha software wasn't easy to create.
It was very challenging. It was inspirational. It was fascinating. It involved a lot of challenges that we had never had to encounter before. In most of our other projects, of course, by definition, there are not an abundant number of language speakers to language experts when we're developing the endangered language software. But in the case of Chittimacha, there were not any. The tribe had already engaged a professional linguist several years prior to working with us, and he had compiled from the archival data a lot of the material into a dictionary and a basic grammar. And from that, the tribe had also developed some basic curriculum materials for use in their tribal school. And so we were working from those kinds of materials with the tribe, and I think that the team members from the Chittimacha tribe, maybe against their will, I'm not sure, became linguists along this throughout this project. And that was maybe an unintended bonus for them, but they definitely had to examine a lot of the archival materials, kind of like putting pieces of a puzzle together. They studied how the Chittimacha language created new words, because that was another challenge that they faced. Of course, a lot of the words were not that in the software were not present in the archival materials, you know, computer or things like that. And so they actually sat down and studied the patterns that the Chittimacha language uses to create new words and followed those patterns to create new words for those terms that were in the software.
Considering the software has only been in the hands of the community for almost 2 months, Walden says it's already making a difference, and the community is very pleased to see the language make a comeback, and it's a dream come true.
Well, we are already seeing great things with bringing back the language, just the pride in the children. You know, my staff and I, growing up, lived on the reservation, and that's what we thought it was to be Chittimacha, and a lot of us longed for our language. You know, you don't understand as a child. You see other tribes that are speaking their language and doing so fluently, and just wanting to be able to communicate and have that unique form of communication was something we wanted. And no one could help us. You know, the elders really were, I guess, conditioned by the circumstances and what they were told by their parents and grandparents that really didn't fit in modern society. It didn't get you anywhere as far as a job or and there were a lot of atrocities done in about the same time our language was dying to our people being poisoned. So what do you do to assimilate? You know, you lose that part of who you are, and language was one of those. So they adopted the language of the area, which was French and then later English. So it took a while for us to achieve our dream, which when I became cultural director, the council right prior to me being hired had found a linguist just kind of accidentally that knew of our language and knew of the recordings and all the material that was held by different places, National Archives, National Anthropological Society, those places that had materials on the language. So we started getting those materials, and then we hired him to start a curriculum because we wanted it in the schools immediately. We didn't want to lose another generation.
Mm-hmm.
So we really started with the kids. A lot of adults are hesitant. Learning a second language in adulthood is intimidating, especially the way we were going about it at first, and it was really technical. And, you know, who remembers all the parts of speech and how to conjugate verbs in English, let alone in a foreign, basically foreign language. So that was a challenge, but, you know, it's really been a dream come true to use all those materials. We're just so fortunate to have those resources and to have found someone that could help us get a start. And now we know it ourselves, and that was a big part of Rosetta Stone was having them to lean on as a resource to make sure we were doing things properly. But really that ownership of the product was tremendous. And really, as a child, would I have ever or thought it would be a reality that we would be speaking our language again? I thought it was hopeless. So it's really, really a dream come true.
The software is an immersion program and interactive. For example, translates to "the man is buying a new basket." After learning the phrase, the user has to correctly match the phrase to a picture. The Chitimacha Rosetta Stone software is the intellectual property of the Louisiana tribe and is sold and distributed by the community. This is the fourth project for Rosetta Stone's Endangered Languages program. Now here's Shane Yellowbird with "What a Beautiful Concept." Did you know when he was young he had a really bad stutter? How he learned to get a handle on it? Singing.
I had a dollar for every time I tried to change for a girl of mine. Well, I'd be a millionaire. Square peg, round hole, sometimes they fit, most times they don't, and it just about kill me every time, I swear. Then there's you, you're the first girl I ever met that said, boy, don't you dare change one thing about yourself, and you know, honey, you'd be alright with me if you're the last girl I ever held, cause you love me just for myself. What a beautiful concept, what a beautiful life, what a beautiful love, what a beautiful concept, what a beautiful life, what a beautiful love. Debbie didn't like to ride in a pickup truck set up so high. Must have been those fancy dresses that she wore. And Cindy couldn't stand my dog at the foot of the bed all night long. Constantly complained how bad he snored. Then there's you. You're the first girl I ever met that said, boy, don't you dare change one thing about yourself. And you know, honey, it'd be alright with me if you're the last girl I ever held, cause you love me just for myself. What a beautiful concept. What a beautiful life. What a beautiful love. What a beautiful concept. What a beautiful life. What a beautiful love. I'm a guy, you're a girl. I've got my things, you've got your world. You go to sleep in my arms at night. When I wake up in the morning, I'm holding you tight. What a beautiful concept. What a beautiful, what a beautiful concept. What a beautiful life, what a beautiful love, what a beautiful concept. What a beautiful life, what a beautiful love, what a beautiful concept. Ooh, yeah, yeah.
There were more than 60,000 people who attended the opening ceremonies for the 2010 Winter Games and more than 3 billion people who watched from their homes. The opening ceremonies were heavily influenced by Aboriginal culture and also included about 350 Aboriginal dancers. And Tracy Recollet was one of those dancers. She performed the Women's Fancy Shawl Dance. The Sudbury, Ontario resident said the experience was pretty intense and a once-in-a-lifetime event.
I received an email in, I received an email in my email, and it was just asking for a youth, Indigenous youth gathering, and you can apply and go to this. So I put my application in, but then I withdrew because, at the time I wasn't sure about the workshops or anything. But then it asked for your regalia, so it got me thinking that we must be doing some kind of dancing or performance down in BC. So they called me back and asked why I withdrew, and I told them, I asked them one question. I said, well, are we dancing in the opening ceremonies? And she said, yeah, but it was really low-key. It was a big secret. So I resubmitted my application, and they choose it based on leadership skills and role modeling and stuff like that.
Awesome. And when you went to the games, how did that feel?
Intense. All that. So I felt really honored. I was excited. It was just surreal. We couldn't believe we're actually a big part of the opening ceremonies. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah. Did you cry?
No. I'm not a crier.
Oh, good.
No, I was pretty good. I got a little teary eyed when after we were done our performance, and an elder came and spoke to us and told us, because you know, years ago this was outlawed, and you know, all these different things that happened before in history. And then being able to show the world about our Aboriginal people. And once you start talking about that, that's when I got a little teary-eyed.
What was it like to enter that place with thousands upon thousands of people in there?
It was pretty intense, but we had 12 hours of rehearsals prior to this. We left January 30th, and we were practicing, and then the few days before the actual opening ceremonies, we did dance on Monday with, I think, 40,000 people, and then Wednesday, 50,000, and then the big opening was 65. So it kind of built us up. Get ready.
Were you nervous at all?
No, actually, I wasn't nervous. I was pretty. I've been dancing all my whole life, so it was awesome. I wasn't nervous. I was just more excited than nervous.
Oh, cool! And while you were there, did you make other connections to communities across Canada?
Oh, yeah. We met so many people all across Canada, Alberta, and then actual people in BC, like the Four Hope First mm-hmm. Nations. We met a lot of people, like youth, and right down to Newfoundland, Nova Scotia. It's pretty awesome. We had our own nights of entertainment. So everyone who had their, you know, whether it's drumming, throat singing, that kind of stuff, we did that at nighttime as our big group.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to say or add about your experience?
Well, it was once in a lifetime thing, and it was just awesome. Like I'll be able to tell my grandbabies these stories, and hopefully they'll continue when, you know, they host Olympics, if they ever do again. Hopefully add Aboriginal feel to it.
That was Tracy Recollet, one of 350 Aboriginal dancers who participated in the opening ceremonies of the Winter Olympics. You've been listening to Bomb Sida with Jennifer Ashwasage. Bomb Sida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bomb Sida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bomseda.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bomb Sida.